Dr. Jenny Gorstein is a psychiatrist, a child psychiatrist living in the Beit Daniel. And as you see, she works at Shaarei Tzedek and Shderot Resilience Center. And it's a pleasure to have her. And okay, Jenny, Vakasha, it's all yours.
Okay, here we go. Thank you so much, Torah in Motion, for inviting me to be a part of this meaningful program. It is an honor, even virtually, to be here among esteemed colleagues. From the moment Simchat Torah ended in the diaspora and word of the terror which hit Israel spread, one of the most reliable weapons we have always had as a nation was enlisted in this war, that weapon being the powerful fabric of our nation. Today's program and the makeup of the community of listeners online is a testament to the strength and unity of our people and the reason we know that this war too will be another victorious and awe-inspiring chapter in Jewish history, though at a cost which right now feels overwhelming to us all. I come from a family of rabbis and educators. I am the only physician in my immediate family. I fell in love with the biology of the human body in seventh grade when my science teacher, a sophisticated, elegant, powerful woman, taught in a way which made the circulatory system riveting. That year, my friends all had posters of TV stars on their bedroom wall, and I had a diagram of the digestive system hanging over my bed, literally. Finally, at the end of seventh grade, I announced to my parents that I am going to medical school. And the next day, my mother came home with a book she bought for me called Behold Man, A Photographic Journey of Discovery Inside the Body by Leonard Nilsen, my first medical textbook. I still use it today when explaining to patients how medication affects synapses. I share this with you because over time I realized that in fact I never left the family business of chinuch. Being a doctor means being a teacher. We listen carefully and we watch for the individual needs of each patient. We teach our patients to listen to their bodies. We teach our patients to care for and respect their bodies. And we teach our patients to marvel at God's creations, even though we don't necessarily use religious language in our lessons. Part of being a doctor during this challenging time has involved teaching our patients about the marvel and wonder of resilience, a human biological function no less miraculous or critical than cardiac or kidney function. In the upcoming minutes we have together, I will share what I have experienced in Sderot as an example of the miracle of the human ability to be resilient. Other than my deep love for Sderot and its people, I have no conflicts of interest to report. Sderot is an Israeli town of about 30,000 people on the Gaza-Israeli border, less than 1 mile away from towns within Gaza. At first glance, Sderot looks like a typical Israeli town. However, Sderot became a target of rocket fire from Gaza in 2001, and since then has been hit with over 10,000 rockets, leading to many deaths, countless injuries, and extensive property damage. In 2005, the Israeli government pulled out from Gaza and handed over control to the Palestinian Authority. However, Hamas, internationally recognized as a terrorist organization, took over the government in 2007, and since then, Sderot has been the target of rocket fire from both Hamas and Islamic Jihad, leading to several battles between Israel and Hamas over the years. As a result of the threat of rocket fire, the city streets are dotted with bomb shelters incorporated into every bus stop. Playgrounds are designed with reinforced, brightly painted caterpillar tunnels seen in these pictures, which serve as a bomb shelter, where children at play seek refuge during rocket attacks. Bomb shelters, also called safe rooms, are incorporated into every home, school, and business. A piercing siren, known as Tzeva Adom, a red alert, indicates incoming rockets from Gaza have been detected, and residents have 15 seconds to seek cover. The Israeli government recognized the need for mental health support for communities situated along the Gaza border, whose residents, like those of Sderot, live under the threat of constant rocket attacks. Resilience centers were established in 5 border towns, providing therapy at no cost to all who request help. The Sderot Resilience Center, Merkaz Chosen Sderot, offers individual, family, and group therapy with social workers, psychologists, art, movement, drama, and animal therapists, forming a staff of 40 mental health providers. The center also offers community resilience interventions, including volunteer trainings, activities to foster relationships between neighbors, and emotional well-being trainings for police, teachers, and other city workers in order to strengthen the community as a whole. The center also offers on-site support during rocket attacks. Staff is on call 24/7. During rocket attacks, they grab their easily visible yellow vests labeled Resilience Center, and they make their presence felt in the targeted neighborhood, offering psychological first aid in homes, in parking lots, and on the street to reduce trauma symptoms. In 2014, after a very painful round of fighting between Israel and Hamas, ignited by the Hamas kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teenagers, two of whom were friends of my son, I received a call from my good friend, Yaki Singer, a social worker who worked in the Sderot Resilience Center. He explained that there was no child psychiatrist in Sderot and told me that I must come help out. I apologetically responded that I was too overwhelmed by the demands of my psychiatry practice in the Jerusalem region of the country, and that I unfortunately did not have a spare day to offer. He persisted, saying, "Jenny, I didn't ask if you could come, I asked when." And so I agreed to travel down monthly to Sderot, each time for a marathon 11-hour day of meetings to address the psychiatric needs of the population. That was my first lesson learned treating communities in trauma. The need for help feels desperate, and pitching in feels like a mission more than any other work I do, driven by the core medical value of service. I share this picture of Yaki today to honor him because he passed away 3 years ago and yet remains with me every moment I am in Sderot. He is an example of the people we all have in our professional stories who have molded the trajectory of our career paths with their encouragement and influence. Before I proceed with more detailed descriptions of my experience, I must pause and explain the background of today's talk. This talk is a slightly modified version of a talk I gave, also virtually, at the conference of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, known as ACAP, on October 27, 2023. I had submitted a proposal describing my work in Sderot in February 2023, when rounds of rocket fire were periodic, at times intense, but there was relative quiet. The talk was accepted as part of a panel about the impact of political conflict on children. On October 7th, as all present are painfully aware, Hamas infiltrated the Israeli border, rampaged through city streets, and raped and massacred men, women, children, babies, and the elderly in their homes and at a music festival, burned down homes with families trapped inside, and kidnapped over 200, including babies and the elderly. 30 citizens of Sderot were murdered within hours. Israelis and Palestinians, Jews, Muslims, Druze, Christians, and others all were murdered on October 7th. I was quite worried about how my talk would be received, given the anti-Semitism that suddenly erupted throughout the academic world following the attack, and was surprised and encouraged by the strong support expressed after my talk by colleagues there, though of course I am still contending with some frustrating backlash as well. Before I proceed explaining the psychiatric content of my work relevant to all patient encounters, I want to describe to you a unique aspect of the war which we are facing. All Israeli hospitals champion coexistence as a core institutional value. Jewish and Muslim physicians and nurses work side by side and treat patients of all religions and races side by side. In Shaarei Tzedek Medical Center in Jerusalem, where I work, one-third of the patients on the pediatric dialysis unit are Jewish children, and two-thirds are Israeli, Arab, and Palestinian children. The department proudly treats children from Gaza as well. Unfortunately, since the war began on October 7th, these Gazan patients have not been able to reach Jerusalem because the Israeli volunteers who drive them from the Gaza border to Shaarei Tzedek for treatment residents of the towns on the Gaza border that were attacked have all been murdered or kidnapped. My nephrologist colleagues are in touch with these patients and are doing the best they can to support them. In my talk at ACAP, I pointed this out to remind my colleagues that the ethical duty of medicine demands that we put aside our differences and focus with determination on our shared joint mission of relieving the suffering of any child who needs our help. Working in Israeli hospitals during this war has been complex and thought-provoking. I was brought into the Resilience Center to fill the role of medical expert, but working in a community hit by trauma is a poignantly humbling experience. The prescription pad is not the expertise needed. Trauma is not healed with medication, especially when trauma, such as war-related trauma, is ongoing. Though technically at times a pharmacological intervention can reduce panic attacks or improve sleep, my second lesson learned treating communities in trauma is that it is relationships which heal, not medicine. In the context of community trauma, I have found that there are three relationships which require nurturing: the relationship between parent and child, the relationship between patient and self, and the relationship between treater and patient. I will first explain more about the relationship between parent and child. The stronger the parent is, the safer the child. The reality of sterile families is that parents and children live with the same potential threat of a siren blaring and rockets falling at any moment. The families who thrive despite that surreal day-to-day threat are the families in which parents have acquired skills of confidence and control, which sets the tone for their children. In traumatized communities, investing in the emotional health of parents deputizes ambassadors of resilience in every home. Yuval is an 8-year-old little boy who came in with his father, Matan. Matan had served in the army and is now suffering with PTSD from his combat experiences. His body language is fearful and hesitant, and he speaks in low tones. He opens the meeting about his son by describing his own fears in front of Yuval in great detail. I try to compassionately but firmly shift the focus to the reason he brought Yuval in. Little Yuval quietly describes that 1 year ago, he had been riding his bike when a red siren alert blared, and he saw that within 15 seconds, he could only reach a stranger's home. A mother took him into her safe room with her kids, but for over a year, he continues to have panic attacks, has been wetting the bed, and insists on sleeping in the safe room every night. Matan explains that his son has been in therapy for several months with no improvement, and so he would like him to begin medication. I ask to speak with Father Matan alone. I explain that if he would allow us to help him treat his own fears, his son Yuval's prognosis could improve. Matan sits up straight and forcefully says to me in an even stronger voice, "I know my son, and I know he needs medication." I realize that the best way to treat this family system is to applaud Matan for knowing what his son needs and to write a prescription, not because I believe medication will be the solution, but because a daily medication ritual will represent a dad who actively cares for and protects his child, and that will help Yuval to heal. In the early hours of Shabbat Simchat Torah, October 7th, we in Gush Etzion, 15 minutes south of Jerusalem, were hearing loud booms in the distance starting at 6:30 a.m., and soon after, sirens blared. The detection system of Azakot alerts you when a rocket is aimed specifically at your neighborhood. We are far enough away from Gaza that we have 90 seconds to get to our bomb shelter. I had already been in my own bomb shelter with my family when my phone began lighting up with texts from my patients in Sderot. Lihi, a mom of several teens and herself my patient, frantically wrote, "There's shooting outside and I see the terrorists from my house." She sent me pictures taken from her window of dead bodies strewn on the street. "I feel like I can't move," she typed furiously. "What should I do?" I asked her where her daughters were, and she told me they were locked in the bomb shelter. Bomb shelters are reinforced to protect from incoming rockets, but ironically, they cannot keep out terrorists armed with guns that can shoot open a lock. I encouraged her to join her daughters. I can't move. I gently pleaded with her again to join them, not only to be safe herself, but because they needed her presence to feel strong. From far away, with my patient under a barrage of rocket fire and facing tangible threat of murder, that was the only intervention I had to offer. Encourage her to draw on her maternal instinct to protect her children. In that way, she could fuel her own strength and be able to nurture theirs. Relationship between patient and self. The clinic is called Resilience Center, not Trauma Treatment Center. The therapeutic message is already being delivered at the entrance. Effectively treating victims of trauma involves focusing less on what hurts and more on what strengthens. In my meetings with patients, I spend time asking about what they appreciate about themselves, what brings them joy, what makes them special. Strong self-esteem is the reinforced safe room of the soul. And though no medicine can magically create a strong self-esteem, encouragement wrapped in the package of a medical professional can spark hope. I recently met with Rotem, whom I first treated as a surly teenager and who has returned to the center for therapy as a mature, articulate young adult. She expressed despair. I will never be free of this cloud over my head. She then paused and reflected as a teenager, she used to always come with her mother. And today as an adult, she came alone. I guess that means I have grown, she said, with a smile glowing with pride. During these weeks of war, most families living within close rocket range of Hamas have chosen to evacuate, as seen in this picture, and are living with friends or in government-funded hotels. We are relying heavily on psychological first aid tools to help patients recognize their sources of strength and construct a narrative which empowers them. When one family decided to leave, Ligal, a spunky 14-year-old, said bitterly, "We decided to run away." I replied, "Ligal, I am so impressed that your family is choosing to temporarily leave home to recharge your batteries so you can return with the energy to rebuild." Relationship between treater and patient. Almost 20 years ago, I was fortunate to be trained by Dr. Victor Fornari, a wise and compassionate supervisor who taught me that there are three golden rules of healing. Number one, patients heal from their pain when you bring yourself into the room. Number two, magical moments will happen if you just listen carefully. Number three, we are all more alike than we are different. As in every field of medicine, authenticity, attentiveness, and humility open up the door for trust, and patients then invite us to hold their pain with them. This picture was drawn after I spent about 30 minutes with Yael. Her father, Or, had asked me to encourage her to talk about her persistent nightmares, which began after a rocket hit their living room as they were locked in the bomb shelter on the other side of the house. But Yael did not want to talk about her nightmares. She wanted to show me videos of her dive that she learned to do while staying at a hotel in the days following their home being destroyed. I oohed and aahed over her bravery and told her I only know how to jump into the pool, not dive, and that I'm in awe of how graceful she is. At the end of our meeting, she asked if she could stay for a few more minutes to draw on the whiteboard. And this is the picture that she drew, a heart with my name. A therapeutic relationship bond can be formed within 30 minutes if you follow the three golden rules of healing. I would like to add a story here that had not yet unfolded when I first gave this talk, but which beautifully represents the power of the relationship between treaters and patients. At the end of November, I went for a routine mammogram and ultrasound, and we discovered a tumor. Thank God, prognostic markers are as hopeful as can be. Treatment protocol is standardized and proven effective, and I'm really going to be totally fine. I made a decision to be open with patients about my situation for two reasons. First, I need to cancel appointments that patients counted on, and I do not want them to think that I do not appreciate their suffering. Also, I want this story to be heard by as many as possible. I went for a routine mammogram feeling completely healthy, and the screening has saved my life. As I continue my work virtually with Sderot patients now evacuated from their homes and scattered over Israel in hotels, I share my medical update with them as I juggle my own medical care with their medical care, including endless paperwork needed documenting their trauma so their government benefits can be received. At times, I must apologize for not having this paperwork as quickly as they need it, because of the many personal medical appointments which now fill my days. Some of my patients in Sderot have their own cancer stories and are particularly overwhelmed and paralyzed by their years of exposure to traumatic terror situations. However, since I shared my update, something magical has happened. They have been mobilized, sharing with me doctors' names, medical tips, encouragement, food ideas, asking for my name for Tehillim, sending me frequent flower emojis, and updating me that they are davening for me. In other words, being in the position of helper and supporter has empowered them to focus much less on their weakness and far more on their strengths. Bringing myself into the room has helped healing more than any other intervention. On the day Sderot was infiltrated by terrorists, a large group of them attacked the police station, and the police on duty were overrun and killed. The terrorists barricaded themselves inside. After many difficult hours, a strategic decision was made to destroy the building in order to successfully capture the terrorists. My friends in Sderot sent me this picture of the demolished police station, and I broke down crying. Again, the building next door to the right is the Resilience Center. I park my car in my favorite spot directly across from that police station every month. I felt a sense of despair. With so much destruction at our own doorstep, what will come of our ability to help patients? It was Irit, the clinical director of the center, who reminded me about my very own mantra of the three relationships which heal. She described to me the scenes at the hotels around the country where Sderot residents are now living, funded by the government. Every psychiatric hospital in the country has been assigned a hotel to oversee, along with groups of social workers from the Social Services Department and representatives of the Ministry of Health. Sderot residents are surrounded by those offering to help them. But in every hotel, they seek out the Sderot Resilience Center staff in their yellow vests and gather around them, holding on tightly to the relationship they recognize and trust, and feeling safe within the already established bond developed over years of consistent presence. It isn't about the healing, Irit reminded me. It isn't about the building, Irit reminded me. It is about the vests. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There are a couple really very powerful, beautiful. There are a couple comments in the chat box, and I think a few people were asking for your three magical, you know, ways to treat people. If you want to take a look, and if anybody has any questions, we have a couple of minutes. We can take a couple. Yes, somebody.
The list of the three items of the Golden Rules.
Yes.
Okay. The Golden Rules are: patients heal from your from their pain. Patients heal from their pain when you bring yourself into the room. Magical moments will happen if you listen carefully. We are all more alike than we are different. Those are really the three guidelines that have guided me for many, many years.
Okay. And I'll read the question. Do psychiatrists research with the IDF? What happens to reservists who are uncomfortable going into combat and possibly killing terrorists?
Okay. So there is a system by which soldiers who feel emotionally unable to serve can get what's called a pitur, which means that they can be excused from service and are sent to non-combat positions if that's appropriate and relevant for them. But the army actually tries to prevent sending soldiers into battle if they don't feel emotionally stable enough to do so. That's actually something that psychiatrists are involved with. We screen for these patients, we write letters, we advocate for them.
How common an issue is that, by the way?
I can't honestly answer with statistics. I don't know. Right. I can tell you that in my own practice, I have cases which go in both ways, meaning I have patients who very much want to serve in combat roles, and because of medical or psychiatric past history, the Army is trying to push them off, and they ask me to help advocate and show that they're healthy and they've been healthy and stable for a long time, and we try to really support their willingness to serve in a combat unit. And in the other direction, patients who are very afraid and ask for help to be excused.
Okay.
But I don't know statistics. There are statistics available. I just don't know them.
Anybody want to ask anything? But Kasha? Jenny, I must say, who is your grade 7 science teacher?
Barbara Fuhrer. She's my hero.
At Maimonides, of course.
At Maimonides in Boston. Yes.
And yes, I know when Jenny says she comes from a family of people in Chinook because we're part of the same family, of course.
I wasn't going to say anything, Jay.
I wasn't going to say, but once you mentioned the family, Chinook, her husband and I are first cousins, but we invited her because of her amazing ability as a psychiatrist. The fact that she's part of the family is just an extra bonus that we get. So really, Jenny, thank you very much for a wonderful presentation, and say hi to Auntie Chayla.
I will. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody? Otherwise, we'll take a few minute break. And Rabbi Yoni Rosenzweig, I don't know if you're on yet, Rabbi, from Beit Shemesh, will be speaking about halakhic aspects of this. This is the one we haven't yet addressed. And okay, thank you, Jenny. Be well. Refuah Shleima.
And thank you.
Everybody, to the entire Jewish people. Hi, Rabbi. Okay, we'll start in, and I think your schedule started at 11:30, so we'll start then. So we can take a short break now, and then we'll resume at exactly 11:30. Okay, Rav Yoni, I'll make you co-host. And then if you'd like to share your screen and say hello.